How to use your emotions is our subject this morning. And it's a very interesting one. It's a very interesting direction. Rather than how to rise above or how to conquer, how to use them for your own highest good. If we're to understand the emotions and what they signify to us as human beings, and even more important to us as devotees, seekers of God. Thank you. It would help us to realize the direction of spiritual development as it applies to this particular subject. People think of the emotions in many different ways, as we see in the different teachings to help you to become a fulfilled human being. They talk about learning not to suppress your emotions, learning how to express your emotions, how to give vent to your emotions, getting in touch with your feelings, and sort of learning how to function in certain ways that people feel may be their answer. Because people live in very many of them in our society particularly, we live suppressed lives. That is to say, people consider it not quite decent to express their feelings. I know in the environment that I grew up in this country, and before that even more so in England, where they have a tendency to keep a stiff upper lip all the time, that it wasn't so in Romania for sure, but on the other hand, we weren't really a part of Romania. It was really an Anglo-American community that I grew up in. In Switzerland also, they tend to be very sort of proper and staid. And so, generally speaking, the environment that I grew up in on both sides of the Atlantic was this kind of environment where people were afraid to express their feelings because they had various reasons. One was that they didn't want to impose their private feelings on other people, but it often came to the point where they didn't want to admit that they really had them. I know that back east, the superlatives that people used were "that's nice" or "that's pretty," never "that's wonderful" or "that's beautiful." It was always sort of contained, and always you had to see two sides of the picture. I remember when I was saying to one of my father's friends something about the movies being rather poor quality. They didn't seem to be, there was so little decent drama in the movies. And this seemed to him an extreme statement. I hadn't been to all movies, and after all, many of them had something good. And I remember him saying, "Well, I don't know." And you just never could say anything without somebody trying to temper your statement and bring it back to sort of a gray average, with the result that you were afraid even to say anything for being thought a fanatic. Or unbalanced. It's a beautiful day, yes, but maybe, after all, it's not beautiful for everybody. And it gets to be quite a drag, no doubt. But it wasn't just the environment I grew up in. It's the environment of this country. It's it's our legacy. And various people get out of it. But if you go, for example, from this country to Mexico or Italy, you quickly find how very much more they are in touch with their feelings, and you begin to wonder, is that such a good thing after all? I love the spontaneity and everything in an Italian household with everybody. I remember somebody sitting across the table about as far from me as you are, Saraswati, and she was carrying on what seemed to her a perfectly normal conversation. Finally, I just couldn't take it any longer, and I said, "Could you do me a favor? Just don't shout." I could hear her perfectly well. I used to think that Puccini was unrealistic because everything was tragic, just everything falling apart all the time and the worst things possible happening. And then I got to Italy, and I discovered that he was very true to life, as Italians know it. And so these are two extremes, And neither one seems to be the answer. But in our culture, because of the tendency towards suppression, there is a great deal of emphasis on getting it all out. And people, in fact, I remember going to some seminars where they put up a board and you were supposed to throw mud at it. And the idea was to get rid of your anger. Well, I just didn't feel any anger, so I felt sort of silly throwing this mud at a board. There was nothing to be angry about. But there's a lot of that, and people who have done it for a few minutes feel good and so relieved. Or they go into a primal scream, and they're screaming their heads off, and afterwards they feel great. Nobody else feels good, but they feel great. In fact, that's one of the problems with this whole thing of releasing your emotions. You feel good, but you've dumped them on somebody else. And then where are they going to pass it? But there's another thing to it, too, and that is that even murderers have been known to feel very relaxed and peaceful and happy after murdering somebody. But it's temporary. The tension builds up. And once you've gotten into that mode, there'll be more and more and more tension. You can't get out of it by just releasing your emotions. What I'm saying is that these different ways of trying to become a well-rounded, perfect human being on a purely human level by learning to express your emotions, give vent to your feelings, let it all hang out, as the expression goes, not a very attractive one, it doesn't seem to give the answer. The fact is that as long as we are living in a human body, we're like a boat in a storm. I remember my mother, who has high blood pressure, met some lady who had low blood pressure, and my mother mentioned that she had high blood pressure. The other woman said, "Oh, aren't you lucky? Now I have low blood pressure." The ultimate in egotism. But you find some people who are very emotional, and you think, "Oh, that's the answer." And those people look at you who are all sort of holding it in, and you think, "Oh, you've got the answer." Nobody has the answer. As long as they're trying to find it on a human level, it's always going to be a sort of a moving up and down and sideways and every which way. The whole answer must be understood in terms of a long-range solution, and that has to be seen also in terms of a spiritual reality. It doesn't happen any other way. All these teachings that we come across today, they all do good, but it's a temporary good. And people start going in that direction, and it's merely the ego learning to handle itself in a new way. But it doesn't give you final release from anything. And you won't become a fulfilled and perfect human being ever as long as you're perfect only in a human way. I mentioned this to Master one time about somebody. I said to Master, "He's so truthful and honorable and honest and kind, and yet he doesn't think about God." Master's comment was, the road to Hades is paved with good intentions. And he didn't mean to put that person down, and he didn't mean that for his goodness he's going to hell. What he did mean was that as long as you seek a perfection, develop it even in a human way, it's going sooner or later to lead to some new mistake. And you'll just be plunged into some new pit until you've learned that the only real answer is in God. So we have to understand it in that way. Otherwise, it's a waste of time even talking about it. You'll find a temporary answer, you'll get rid of your inferiority complex, and you'll start throwing your weight around, and suddenly everybody's going to want to pull you down, and then before you know it, you've got another inferiority complex for other reasons. It just goes up and down and up and down all the time. The definition of yoga is the neutralization of the vortices of feeling. And of course, the feelings are the emotions. And it's the feelings that really keep us tied to delusion. It's because of our attachments and our likes and dislikes that we're here. The ego in itself needn't do that. It's attachment to ego and the things of ego that does it. if you know that you've got a body to take care of, if you know that you have certain responsibilities in this world, and you do them, but with the right motive, that is to say, without likes and dislikes, but with a sense of duty, with a sense of pleasing God, then your ego won't be a bondage. The ego, in fact, is your passport to salvation. The animals don't have a chance to grow spiritually, essentially because they don't have egos. Granted, they don't have brains either, but they don't have egos. And, I mean, by brains, they don't have the discrimination to be able to see. But it's the sense of self. It's the sense of wanting to do something about your own lot to grow spiritually that you need if you're ever to get out of ego and into the soul. So don't just use ego as a catch-all, because it has negative and positive connotations. If you use your ego to grow, if you use your ego to say, I want to live for God, I want to find God, I want to offer myself into His love, this is necessary. To say, oh, I am separate from God, I am important, I'm better than other people or worse than other people, my good is the only thing that matters, no matter what happens to them, that kind of thing is certainly going to cause delusion. But the sense of self by itself is not delusion. The delusion comes when that ego says, oh, I like having these things that belong to me. I like having my house and my family and my job and my friends, and I don't like people who don't treat this ego the way I want it to be treated. And so you find yourself defending, protecting, attacking, and you get involved in the whole storm of Maya. You get involved in all the ups and downs of a Puccini opera. Well, what we've got to do is learn to calm these feelings. This is the essence of yoga. And it's a most interesting definition, because usually you think of yoga, which means union. You define it. This is the normal definition, the only one that most people could really understand. You define it in terms of uniting yourself with God. If you're into psychology, perfect and total self-integration. If you're into holistic healing, the holistic healing of body, mind, and soul, and making yourself completely whole, completely healthy on all levels. These are definitions people can understand, uniting the lower self with the higher self if you're into philosophy and so on. But the neutralization of the vortices of feeling, that's a very hard one to work with. And yet once you've started getting into it, you discover that you've got a handle on a very deep and wonderful truth. Because in fact, we are already that. And if we can completely harmonize our vibrations, if we can completely calm ourselves and get rid of likes and dislikes, then we discover that we're becoming more and more completely centered in the self. Thursday night, I started to tell something, and my whole mind this week has been on writing a song, which I want to spring on you tomorrow morning. But it's really a great song, I think. Anyway, I forgot to finish a thought that I had started. I was saying how in writing another song, I wanted to go up to a higher note, and I realized that if I did so, it would be emotional rather than feeling. And I had to come up to a lower note than that one, and on a different note, not just that note. I had to delay it a little bit, and as I put it, come in on the noun instead of the of the adjective. Well, what was interesting about that, and that I forgot to say, was that what made it emotional was that it implied too long a stretch from the basic note. Here is the tonic note, and you can go so far, and it's okay. You go a little bit further, and it becomes too thin, like a rubber band, and there's tension and stress there. And that, applied to what we're talking about here, is a very interesting thought, because if you really want to live in the divine, to go a little bit outward. That thing that Master said to me, he said, always live in the self. Come down a little bit to talk, to eat as necessary, then return into yourself again. That idea of being centered and doing what has to be done, doing it with the right kind of joy, the right kind of attitude, but always coming back to your center. This is what music does. You'll notice that, and music is a language, it's a very interesting thing to explore, because you find how clearly it's saying certain things that can't even be said with words. I mean, I can express that if you get too far away from the central thing, then you get into emotion. I can say it, but music gives you the experience of that. And you may experience it without understanding that that's what's happening. Still, it'll affect you. So, anyway, songs almost always end on the tonic. The tonic means the starting note of the scale. It's the rule of music, and the ear demands that you end on that note. And when you don't end on that note, it's a very intriguing thing for music to do. Sometimes it doesn't end on that note, but it's because it wants to leave you hanging. It's sort of like Jagannath, the image of Jagannath in Puri. It's an image of Krishna, and deliberately they've cut the arms off. The idea of leaving the statue imperfect is that perfection implies something closed in, whereas leaving it imperfect leaves the door open to infinity. And we can't perfect that which is infinite. And so we leave it imperfect deliberately as just a reminder of something that is infinite. Well, in the same way, music sometimes does that. It leaves you on a note that isn't there in order to sort of keep your mind going outward in expansive ways. But normally speaking, it always brings you back, as you yourself do, back to your center. Emotions are always in pairs. They always go in opposite directions from this one point of rest in the center. The whole law of duality is expressed through this constant flux. Duality meaning that spirit is in the center. Spirit is motionless. Spirit vibrates and creates the universe. And for the sake of those of you who are new here, I should just briefly touch on the fact that one spirit, in order to manifest itself in creation, moves in opposite directions from that state of rest in the center. To use the illustration of the ocean, you can never change the level of the ocean by creating a wave, no matter how high the wave, because always there will be a compensating trough for to even out the level of the ocean at the same as it always was. No matter how many waves there are, the mean level of the ocean will always remain the same. So it is that in creation, everything moves in two directions. It would have to. It can't just remain stationary. I saw the Joffrey Ballet in New York a year ago, and it was interesting to see them because they're excellent dancers, but their philosophical basis, at least of the dancing that I saw, was totally false. It's some modern-day theory that you don't want to repeat anything. You just keep letting each movement evolve into a new movement, into a new movement, and so on. And I noticed that there was a feeling of dissatisfaction with that. It never came back to anything. It just kept moving. Life isn't like that. Our own nature isn't like that. We don't want things to be like that. We don't want to just keep going and going and going. At night, we have to go to sleep. We have to go back into ourselves again. On the path, we have to meditate. We have to come back to this calm center, and it's from this center that we can act again. And so, in all classical dancing all over the world, this is just some harebrained theory that somebody came up with to be different. But it's not the way life is. You'll find that in all dancing in the world, there will always be movement this way and then movement this way. Our nature is dualistic. It's got right and left, positive and negative. Everything wants to balance itself out. And this is the way that nature made us. This is the way God made nature. So, for every up feeling, there is a down feeling. And just as when the waves are high, the troughs also are deep, so also when the emotions are high, the opposite emotions, let's say the emotion of joy, if it's a joyful emotion, and to make this thought very clear so you don't have it hanging over your heads as a doubt, joy, if it's internal, if it's spiritual, this is the only intense joy people can feel, because if you've got a joy that's an extension out here, it's a stretching, there's tension involved in it, and as a result, you have to pull back from it sooner or later. But if you can find a joy that's centered in yourself, and that's what the joy of the soul is, that's what spiritual joy is, then there isn't any opposite to that. We're talking of emotional joy as opposed to true joy. That kind of joy that's an extension outward that you have to reach out to grab will always be followed by some kind of depression. They're just, you can't get away from it because that's the way you're made. There will always be some sort of compensation. Now, the normal thing for people is to think, well, if I just go a little bit further, like that Joffrey ballet, if I just let each thing evolve into something else and something else and something else, and I keep pushing that limit of my joy as far as I possibly can, maybe I'll even break away from this whole pattern of unhappiness and get into total joy. This is really, I should say, the basis of the expression blowing your mind. People say this blows my mind, and they sort of want something to come along that will snap them out of themselves into a perfect state of whatever they want. Joy, peace, love, inspiration, LSD trips, whatever it might be. It's nothing, none of it's real. You can't just get out of your skin and find it that way. It always has to be that you'll come back and have to face the music. You'll have to face what you did. You'll have to learn your lessons. You'll have to go alone into the night at death. You alone, with everything that you have created for yourself, and nothing that you made out there is yours. It's all just a kind of escapism that will never happen, because you can never escape yourself. You may be able to escape the slums you grow up in or whatever. You can't escape yourself. So the fact is that the more you push toward joy, the more you have to experience just as intense and opposite pain. That's why it's curious, but you'll find that comedians tend to be very morose people. It's strange. You'd think they'd be happy, but every one of them. I thought Bob Hope was an exception. John Ball tells me absolutely no, he's the worst. He's very mean-spirited, selfish, strange. But he manages to put up a good front. But others, like Peter Sellers, and every one of them, as far as I know, was this way. I'd like for it not to be true, and I'm sure that there are some people who can be very comical, who are centered in themselves and therefore don't have that problem. But anybody who thinks that he's going to get it this way is going to get it in the neck from the other side. So the answer cannot be found in the way that most people seek it. It cannot be found in just creating more and more good things for yourself. And that's the big mistake with the psychological approach to the exclusion of the spiritual, the psychological approach to human perfection. Getting self-confidence and learning how to get along with people and learning how to impose your will on others and all those things, they just don't work as long as it's outside. Now, the answer is not apathy. Many people might think, well, but if I'm not supposed to be joyful, then I've got to stop feeling. And here's the problem that we get into on the spiritual path. It's a false solution, but it's one that people very often go towards. They think that because we have to learn not to get emotional about things, therefore we've got to learn to not feel. Feeling is absolutely essential. It's emotion that isn't good. We have to be able to feel, And I must say that I'd rather see somebody emotional than somebody who suppresses his emotions in the name of not being in delusion. For example, Italy. Italy is, as I said, a country with a great deal of emotional self-expression. But in the whole Western world, there have been more saints in Italy than anywhere else. And it's only partly because the Vatican happens to be in Italy, and so they know what's going on there more. It's only partly that. There is a capacity among those people there, if they can turn their emotion toward devotion, to go much more quickly than people who don't have feeling and pride themselves because of it. We need devotion, and if it has to be first through emotion, then that's not bad. It's only that that's by no means the end. We've got to, I remember Master saying when he had us chanting in the chapel one time, he said, whip up feeling in your hearts. Well, when you whip up feeling, that means allowing yourself to feel emotion. One of the monks at Mount Washington got very sort of emotional about his search. And I remember him weeping loudly in meditation and so on. And one of the other ministers wrote Master a note, or no, scolded him. And so he asked Master, is it okay? Well, naturally, Master himself used to say it's good to try to control it. But Master was more in harmony with that expression than no expression. And so he said, by all means, it's all right. Roll on the floor with your devotion. And that is emotion, isn't it? When you're weeping and rolling on the floor and so on. Master wanted people to have more of that expression and then turn it inward. But if you've got nothing to turn inward, you've got nothing to be proud about. Most people who, especially this is so in the northern climes, most people who are on the path tend to try to suppress their emotions in the name of neutralizing their feelings. Well, the answer is to have that feeling, but direct it in the right way. Direct it toward God. We need to learn not how to suppress the feelings, but to use them for our own highest good. Because our feelings are really almost, you might say, our rocket fuel. It's Master defined willpower as desire plus energy directed toward fulfillment. And again, an interesting thing in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that nobody ever overcame or got out of karma, out of action, by not acting. He said the way to overcome karma is to act and direct that action in the right way toward God. And if we apply that to emotion, which is a certain kind of action, then we have to see it in the same way, the same light. That we don't overcome emotion by not feeling. We overcome emotion by directing that feeling always toward God. And yes, there is certainly the danger of being more agitated if you allow yourself to start feeling in the first place. But on the other hand, if you offer that feeling up to God, then you will find that there is a peace that comes into your heart that will never be there if you simply refuse to recognize that there is a problem in the first place. The problem won't go away. The feelings won't go away. They'll just be pushed down into the subconscious and be allowed to fester there. To get rid of the emotions, or then to use the emotions in the right way, instead of saying, I don't feel this, try to direct that feeling in some more constructive way. That would be an explanation, although there was certainly a divine response involved also, but an explanation for the way that for what I experienced after we lost that temple, when it burned down. My first reaction was to say, it doesn't matter, I'm not attached. And I remember going into a store that day singing, and the lady in the store said, you're singing, in astonishment. And I said, well, why not? I lost a temple, I didn't lose my voice. But I felt sort of, at the same time, a little bit of numbness, because I wasn't I was non-attached, but at the same time, there was a little feeling in my heart, could I have done something wrong that made this happen? Is God displeased with me? And so I sat down and I prayed to God, and I said, everything that I have done, I've done for you. But if there's any corner of my heart that hasn't been given to you, I give it to you now. And I felt his response. And it flooded me with such joy that I just was overcome by it. But the thing is that joy was also my willingness to face that feeling and offer it up rather than just say, I don't have it. I'm not attached. And does that mean that I should not have worked on the attachment first? I don't think so. I think both sides were necessary in that particular little thing. And because it ended in such joy, I have to say that I did it in the right way. And I'm passing that on as something to consider in your lives. That when something like this happens, first of all, pull back from it. Otherwise, you get swept away by the current. You want to, if somebody's in the water and floundering and you want to save them, if you know that you've got a little bit of time, then you'll look for the best place to go into the water. If you just jump in where they jumped in, you might have two people drowning. And so to pull back a little bit first and to affirm that you aren't attached personally and then to allow your feelings to come and direct them in the right way is the way to have them flow with control. Otherwise, you'll find that they will snatch you out of your grasp, snatch themselves out, and just tear along on their own. They have their own momentum, and once you've got somebody who's hysterical, there's nothing you can do with them. The classical way to stop somebody from having a hysterical fit is to slap them. They can't control themselves. They're just weeping without knowing even what's happening. They've lost utter touch with their ability to reason. Well, we don't want emotions to take us that way. We want to be in the driver's seat. This is what we mean by using our emotions. We want to be able to hold back enough. Really, the best balance would be the Anglo-Saxon and the Italian, you might say. This is the kind of balance I used to see in India, where they have much more ability to express emotion, and yet there's always that sense of distance, too. That sense of withdrawal into the self, and from that center, handling it. You will find it helpful if you will put an emotion in its heat of the moment, put it on a shelf for a moment, and get centered in yourself, and then deal with it. That's not suppressing it. That's coming to grips with it in a way that can use it and direct it wisely instead of merely becoming a slave to it. The emotions are, in fact, the cause of our delusion. They are that which binds us to the world. But the cause, always implied in a cause, is a cure. And the emotions, also rightly directed, are your way out of delusion. You use the emotions in the right way, you get out of emotionalism into feeling, and through that feeling, you can release yourself from bondage to lower feeling. In other words, we have to try to substitute right emotions for wrong emotions. We have to learn how to direct. It's all energy anyway, and it's energy going in one direction. We've got to learn to direct it in a new direction. We have to keep ourselves at that point where we realize that this is not we, that these feelings that we have are passing through. They are not our true self. I've often thought of our body in that way too, that this body, every cell of this body, every molecule, will change over a few years. Some of them change from day to day. You eat food, the food goes out into the body and becomes the nails, the hair, the skin, the muscles, the fat, and all the different parts of the body. And then gradually gets sloughed off and new food comes in and takes that job over. Well then, what are you? Are you that food? The food passes through. In fact, this body is the astral body creating a kind of holding pattern of energy, of magnetism. And with this magnetism, it creates certain holding patterns that say, here is where you make nails, and here is where you make skin, and here is where you make the heart, and so on. And these molecules, the energy goes out, the molecules go out and assume this form for a while, and then they move on and others come in and take that same position. But you aren't that body at all. The body that you're sitting in right now is merely a few molecules fitting themselves into place, into the kind of energy pattern that you have created with your own thoughts. And in fact, if a person could get deeply enough into his own thoughts, he would be able to change that energy pattern and heal himself. And that's the source of miraculous, so-called miraculous healing. It isn't really miraculous. Nothing is really miraculous. What it does is help you change your consciousness on a deep enough level that it's that change will affect the pattern. And as soon as that pattern is changed, then the molecules obediently go ahead and fit themselves to the new holding pattern. And that energy pattern also isn't really you, because it's just your thoughts. Your thoughts have been putting that kind of energy out, but you change the thoughts, and then the energy changes. The same thing with your emotions. That it seems to you so much a part of yourself, the way you feel about things. This is you, but it's not you. It only seems to be. And when you can change your feelings and direct them in a new way, you'll find that you are somebody else. And yet it's the same you behind that new kind of feeling, that new kind of approach. So don't be attached to your feelings, and yet use them. Accept them, direct them in the right way. And the way to do that is always to return first to yourself. Don't act under the influence of emotion. Try to get your emotion centered, get yourself centered, and then use that emotion in a more constructive way. You'll find that under the influence of emotion, you'll always say something or do something that you regret later on. Just about always. Speaking personally, I think I can say always, but I'm not sure I can say it for you. It's very important to be able to speak from a center. Be centered first, then speak. Don't talk off the top of your head. In the autobiography of a yogi, there's a very interesting comment made about Ananda Moyi Ma. Master says that her sole allegiance to God alone, he says, man, oh dear, how does he put it? About how we satisfy our conscience by a false allegiance to lower things like charities and altruistic work and so on. We try to satisfy this heart's need for loving God alone. But she has given her heart solely to loving God. And all other duties to her are not important. In the Bhagavad Gita also, it says, forsaking all things, cleave thou unto me. This is the highest teaching, if you can do that. And so it is that many people will, in working with their emotions, will try to work with some lesser thing, and thus feel that they're not, that they're really dealing with the reality of it. They don't want to face the actual thing. It's sort of like a silly story comes to my mind. It doesn't quite fit, but we'll see if we can make it fit. In England, back a few decades ago, it was not considered proper to talk during meals. And particularly, this was so in one's discipline of one's children. And so there was this father eating his soup, and his son kept wanting to say something, and the father said, be quiet, son, after you've had your soup, then you can speak. And the son, but, quiet, like this. Finally, at the end of the soup, when the father had eaten the soup, he said, what was it, son? And the son said, well, Daddy, you had a fly in your soup. And so people have, can I make something of that story? I don't know. People have a tendency not to want to handle there's this noise going on over here from this emotion, and they don't want to face that, and so they're doing something else. They're trying to direct their energy very properly toward a lesser emotion or a different emotion, and thinking that they're handling it that way. Well, sometimes it can be done that way, but usually, and this is the normal problem in this country, to look at the problem as it really is. Don't pretend it isn't there. Don't try to ignore it. Don't try to sort of keep it in silence. But look at it where it is. There is this normal thought that people will have, especially when they're on the spiritual path. Oh, I didn't really say something nasty about that person because I'm a devotee, and devotees don't say things that are nasty, and therefore it must have been done with some other motive. And you'll find people kidding themselves like this. It would be far better to, at least to yourself, you don't have to tell other people, because they may hold it over your head when they're angry with you or something, but at least in yourself, look at yourself honestly. Be willing to be wrong. I don't mean be willing to stay wrong, but be willing to admit that you made a mistake. Because, in fact, there's a lot of release that comes to people in that simple admission. If they can bring themselves to say, yes, I was wrong. This is the universal human reaction to say, it feels so good to have said that. Strange, isn't it? But it's because then you can do something about it. Then you can release it. You won't release it if you just try to say it didn't happen. This is the way people are with sins and crimes and terrible things that they do. Either it didn't happen, or yeah, but I didn't do it, or various other self-justifications. It would be far better to look right at the heart of it. In fact, that was something we talked about on Thursday evening. The question that Lewis raised was about that teaching of Masters that spirit is, divine vision is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. From the center of everything, it's looking out toward everything else. A very interesting thought in itself. But to get to the center of a thing is really to understand it. And, well, I had this experience in a dental chair one time where I couldn't overcome the pain, and so I looked at the pain and just gazed at it deeply, accepted it, instead of, because I found I couldn't divorce my mind from it, just going right down into the center of it. And once I got to the center of it, suddenly it vanished. It's almost like what Ramakrishna used to say, this example that I've given you of peeling an onion. You keep peeling the onion and peeling it, and finally you get down to the center, and what have you got left? Nothing. You get down to the center of an emotion, to the center of a feeling, and suddenly you discover that it's gone. Many times, if you can watch it, but you've got to watch it calmly. You can't get involved in it in an emotional way, otherwise you'll never get to its center. You'll be on the storm, in the storm, that's on the periphery. But if you can get down right into the heart of it, and you can do that if you're doing it from your heart, from your center, just watch that emotion. For instance, you get very angry with somebody because they've done something that upset you very much. And you can't, and this is the way almost everybody does, I'm not angry. Well, come on, you see me, oh, I'm not angry, shut up, will you, I'm not angry. And so it just bursts out in all sorts of other ways, but they keep saying, I'm not angry, I'm not angry. The operative word is not, but angry, isn't it? But if you will get yourself a little bit calm, I know this was what Jerry Torgerson in SRF did one time. He had rather a temper, and he was on a construction job working on India Center, and he got all angry about something and stormed off, and Andy, the foreman, said, well, don't go away mad, Jerry. And Jerry said, you want me to come back and go away madder? So I think he did the right thing in going away at the time, to get away and get a little calm. But then if you will look at the anger itself and just look at it dispassionately, whether you're getting to its center and it disappears, or whether anger itself gets sort of embarrassed being stared at, I'm not quite sure, but it does have a way of disappearing. And you'll find yourself able to probably laugh at the whole thing. It just isn't that important. The emotions that you feel are not in themselves bad. It's what you do with them. They represent energy. And to have no energy certainly doesn't help anybody to grow. You need a great deal of energy to go toward God. But if you can watch that energy and turn it in a constructive way, for example, for every negative emotion, there is a positive emotion. I can't say always, just in general, for example, what's the opposite of emotion of anger, because it depends on the situation. It depends on what you're doing and how you feel at that time, what you're angry about, whom you're angry with, what your own personality is. When I first studied Master's book, The Psychological Chart, I spent a long time, and it turned out to be a wasted time, trying to find for every negative quality its opposite, so that I could offer people a way out of the negative into the positive. But Master didn't offer it that way, and I couldn't tie it together that way. I saw the qualities, and they didn't work. And then I realized that the way was just each quality. It doesn't have its own opposite. It may have many different opposites, depending on what its cause is, what the context is, who's having it, and so on. And it'll always be a directional thing. It's not so much toward a specific opposite. Anger can come from many sides of the wheel. The final answer is in the center, but meanwhile, the opposite to anger that's coming from here may be west, and the opposite to anger that's over here may be east, and they may seem like opposite answers to the same basic emotion. So it's not that simple. It's too simplistic to try to look for a universal rule. At least I've never been able to make it work. I just don't think it's intended to be that way. However, if you will, first of all, examine your own heart and try to find what would be the cure in your case. Secondly, even if you don't know what your emotions are, what emotions might be in your subconscious that may explode someday, you don't know everything that's there. There are certain things that you can do that will help you anyway. And those are to awaken your feeling and always direct it toward God, whatever it is. Whatever feeling you have, give it to God. Whatever feeling you have, give it toward serving God. Offer it to Him. This, in a general way, and this defines the path of Karma Yoga, if you will always act for God and always give the fruits of your actions to God, even without knowing, and this is why a great deal of self-knowledge isn't necessary. Master didn't ever, or I can't say didn't ever, I wasn't with him all the time, but I was with him enough to see that it was very unusual anyway, for him to sit down and tell you your faults. You'd think that's the first thing he'd do, isn't it? You'd think that would be the whole process. Point this out so you can deal with it. But in fact, very often, even while he was working on you to change something, he wouldn't be telling you what it was, because he knew it didn't matter. Isn't that the odd thing? The important thing is that you get the right energy going, and with that right energy flow, you'll come to understand it in the right time, because it'll release that flow from the negative into the positive, even without your deliberate intention. Yes, you can see these things sometimes. Clearly, yes, Master showed them to you sometimes. He'd say you have this to work on or that to work on, but not usually. And if you compare that with the things that he could have told you, then you have to say he didn't say much. He was much more concerned that you direct your energy in a positive way. He was much more concerned that with that positive energy flow, you create a wake. It's sort of like a boat in the water with the wake, or like that movie, the breaking away of these cyclists, and how this one cyclist got behind a moving truck and was able to go about 60 miles an hour because he was carried by the wake. I don't know if that's the word, but what is the word? Huh? Slipstream. Is that it? Okay. Behind the truck. Well, the same thing is true with you, that if you put out enough energy in a good way, even without knowing these things, you will find that all your energy starts to get sucked in that direction. Now, there are obvious ways. I've told this one before. It's worth sharing with you again, those of you especially who haven't heard it. And that is, back in 1955, I went to Europe. And we didn't have much money there. I think my allowance was $15 a month. And so I saved up a little bit. But I went to Europe, and I bought a lot of presents for everybody, and I enjoyed doing that with it. Then I had about $12 left, and I saw a beautiful little wood carving of the Virgin Mary. And I thought, oh, I'd love to get that. And there was this desire for that beautiful wood carving. And then it occurred to me that I hadn't bought something yet for Diamata. And I only had enough money to buy that wood carving. So I bought it for her, gave it to her. And I found that there was much more freedom in buying it, but not for myself. There was the satisfaction of buying it, but there was also the greater satisfaction of giving it. And moreover, I was able to enjoy it more that way. I remember a photograph that I bought of the Horse's Head Galaxy, and I found it at an observatory, and it was so beautiful. And the stars were really what got me started in a spiritual direction anyway, just the contemplation of their beauty. I used to want to be an astronomer. And so it meant a lot to me to get this thing, and I bought it, and I put it on the wall, and oh, it was such a lovely addition to my room. 2 years later, I happened to notice, oh, there it was. In 2 years, I never looked at it once. And so I think probably I enjoyed the statue more than I would have if I'd bought it for myself. Other people might have also had the care, if they'd been attached to the thing, of, oh, well, I've got to be careful not to break it, and polishing it, cleaning it, and all these different things, and it would be just one more trap. But in my case, I would much more likely have become the usual absent-minded professor who doesn't notice what's around him that way. And whenever I would visit Diamata, I would see it right there in her room, and I'd enjoy it all over again. Not only that, but Dr. Stoelker in Rome had a desire to give me something. She said that she had wanted to share this statue with me. And she gave me a statue of the Virgin Mary, a wood carving at least as beautiful as the one that I hadn't gotten for myself. And that's what's sitting in my house there. And so when you do things for others, especially with the thought that you're really doing it for God, then He always gives it back to you, in His own time, in His own way. Master saw carpeting for the hallway at Mount Washington, and he saw the carpeting and said, that would be perfect for the hallway at Mount Washington. And then he said, no, Divine Mother, you'll give it to me when you want me to have it. He waited 20 years, but exactly that same pattern was given to him. And that's what's in the hallway, I presume, at Mount Washington now. Sometimes God doesn't do it immediately, but if you allow Him to do things, you'll be amazed at how wonderfully He does them. Again, it won't be possible for Him to do that if you have attachment, if you cling to it, if you get in the way. That's why the Bible says, seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things shall be added unto you. So to use your emotions in the right way, the first thing is to use them in a positive way. Use them in a way that turn negative emotions into positive emotions rather than suppressing the negative emotions. Use that energy. All right, for example, you feel angry with somebody. You shouldn't feel angry with people. It's an obstacle in the spiritual path to feel angry with people. And therefore you tell yourself, no, I'm not angry, and I can't stand that guy, but I'm just not going to allow myself to express it. And you get it held down like this, and you're killing a lot of energy. It would be a wonderful thing for you if you would go out and do something for that person. That may be a bit much, huh? But you'll find, surprisingly, that if you can direct it in a positive way, that there's a tremendous flow of positive energy and joy that comes in the process. And if doing something for that person, or you have a wish to talk against somebody, instead you talk for him and say good things about him, find something nice to say. In fact, that's a very good discipline, isn't it? It would be something worth trying. You could just give yourself that assignment for a week, that every time you think of something unkind or unpleasant or negative to say about somebody, try to find something else positive and use that same energy to talk about him, but use it in a constructive way. Say good things. You won't be suppressing that energy then. You'll be releasing it. Releasing it for spiritual development, finally. Negative emotions into positive ones. Anger, hatred, jealousy, selfishness, passion, greed. All these things can be converted into their counterparts, into more positive flow. The second thing is that that positive flow should take you toward calmness. It shouldn't be out of control. It should come from your inner center. The third and most important thing is that it should be shared with God, directed toward God. Otherwise, you just substitute a down wave for an up wave, and where are you? Our whole purpose, particularly as devotees, but even as human beings, if we really want to get free from something, then we have to understand that alone, which will give us that freedom. If you direct it toward God, then you will be directing yourself gradually toward freedom. Only God can give you that freedom. You can't give it to yourself. You've got so many cards in the deck. And no matter how many times you shuffle it, all you do is change the sequence of the cards. You don't add a card, you don't take away a card. It's the same deck. It's when you get in touch with this higher energy that you find a new kind of power becoming infused into your life. And with that power, you suddenly find new insights, new understanding, new energy for real change. In other words, the real change spiritually isn't anything that we can do for ourselves. What we want to do in working on ourselves is to bring ourselves to that point where we are open to the inflow of His grace. His grace is not particular. It's universal. It's like the sunlight on a building. But we've got to open up the windows and pull apart the curtains so that that light can come in. That's our job. The greatest thing that we can do isn't really working on our emotions or using our emotions, but turning them in devotion to God, offering ourselves up to God and saying, "You alone can really help me." Otherwise, all the psychology in the world isn't going to do anything for anybody. That's why, to me, psychology is really kindergarten stuff. Because all it does is temporarily make people feel better about a few petty little things, and maybe they're no longer all upset because their mother did something to them when they were five and withheld the candy box or whatever, or their father beat them, or whatever the subconscious traumas that they've experienced, that we've all experienced. We need to face these things. We need to go through them. It would be good. In fact, it's a very wholesome therapy to be able to look back and find what it is that's really got you bound up in some kind of a knot that is keeping you from being truly happy, truly at peace with yourself, and so on. But remember what Jesus said. The one unforgivable sin, what is it? Does anybody know? Huh?
Blasphemy.
No? No? Sin against the Holy Ghost. That's the unforgivable sin. You can forgive even treachery in time. Judas himself finally got out of it, Master said, in this century. Took a couple of thousand years. But the one unforgivable sin is against the Holy Ghost. What makes it unforgivable is because you have to forgive yourself. A sin against the Holy Ghost means getting out of tune with the sound of Om, out of tune with that inner guidance, closing yourself off to that flow of grace. And that's what almost everybody is guilty of, that sin. They think that through psychology and psychiatry and self-analysis and all these various schools of self-development and self-expression and so on, that they're going to get anywhere. You can't, because you're still working with the same deck of cards. The only way that you can get that new thing into your life that's really going to change you, without which there won't be a real change, it'll only be sort of a reshuffling, is by allowing the grace of the divine to enter your consciousness. The only real cure, ultimately speaking, is God. the one thing that our culture is doing everything it can to avoid. All the teaching is to say, yeah, well, but we have to leave God out of the picture. We have to think about what we can do. Well, that's all right up to a point, but there still has to come that point where we open ourselves to a greater reality. And by ignoring that, we just can't possibly get out. Even theologians in this century have been writing that, well, forget about God and don't bother to love God. He can take care of himself. You've got to love people. And it all sounds very nice, especially to other people. But is are people becoming more religious as a result of it? Not really. They're leaving the spiritual path in droves. No, the only answer, and this is what I wish we could get across in the churches too, because the churches are all trying to become relevant by forgetting God and getting out into the streets where the politics are. I had to sit and listen to this minister in England talk very angrily about how we've got a politicized religion, and I just got up and basically disagreed with him afterwards. I don't normally do that to another speaker, and he was furious, but then he was furious before I spoke. He was just a furious man. And the religion is meant to help man to understand that there is a higher dimension, superconscious living. All great inspirations come from that superconscious level. All inspiration, even for art, for solutions to our work and problems in life and everything, that every great discovery has come through some level of attunement with the superconsciousness. And those people who aren't in touch with it, they can think and think and think, and the high answers never come to them, because you can't create those answers. You can't create those inspirations. You have to get yourself out of the picture. This song I was working on this week, the melody came to me Sunday night, and it was a wonderful melody. And I thought to put it with instruments, a French horn and piano and a few other instruments. And then I stood back from it, and I said, well, what if I put words to it? And then the words started to come. And for a while, the words were such that I could fit in the instruments too. And I thought to do both, but by the time I'd finished with the words, they were so inspiring that I felt that any instrumentation would be a come-down. And so I had to get rid of the whole idea of French horns and instrumental interludes and just concentrate on the power of the words themselves. That came from asking God. I couldn't have created those words just by thinking them through. Certainly I had to think, but I had to listen. That's how anything that we ever do that is meaningful in our lives has come to us. That somehow, through a little crack in our conscious mind, in our egos, whatever it is, the divine is able to flood in. Well, what we want to do... Yes, Kalyani?
I have a question on that.
Yes?
If you're giving yourself to God and today you get over a certain emotional thing that's wrong... And you say, thank God I've raised myself up out of that. And then time after time after time, you keep experiencing that same emotion. I feel like I'm not getting to the root of whatever the problem is. But it keeps coming back and then just...
That isn't really the answer, no. You could use the illustration of a nail in a board. You don't know how long that nail is. You know that if you keep pulling, sooner or later it'll come out. And what you've got here is not... I know there's always that hope for the great breakthrough, and very often that breakthrough happens, but only in the same sense that you've finally got just a tiny bit there in one big tug, and suddenly it's out. And so you think, oh, at last I've understood. It's sort of a Satori feeling, that now at last I know. But that knowledge comes from many, many years often of prying away at that nail, and finally it works its way higher and higher and higher and then out. And so any deep-seated delusion, any deep-seated difficulty, such as what you're talking about, it's true that sometimes the great miracle happens, but even that great miracle happens because there's such powerful good karma, such powerful good energy in that direction that the revelation is there. But otherwise, no. It will be repeated effort, repeated understanding, repeated. Remember what Milarepa, in his life, he committed that terrible sin of destroying a whole family. Uncles, cousins, aunts, everybody was killed by black magic, which of course is a worse way to do it, because when you know, when you use the knowledge of subtle law for evil, you're doing it in a much worse way. The karma is more powerful. And he knew he'd have to suffer. But he didn't want to have to suffer for incarnations. He wanted to get to liberation in that same incarnation. And so he found Guru Marpa, who was a great saint in Tibet, who had brought the yogic teachings, or I guess his guru maybe, I forget which, had brought the yogic teachings for up to Tibet from India. And he wanted initiation. And Guru Marpa said, well, I'll give you initiation after you've built this house for me. And so he told him to build it on a house on a hill up there. And Milarepa was busy building and almost had it finished when Guru Marpa came and he said, no, that's not where I told you to build it. I wanted it on that hill. And meanwhile, he wasn't giving him this initiation, and Milarepa, with some good cause, was thinking that my life is slowly slipping away and I'm not even initiated. How can I begin to work out the karma for this terrible sin? I came for initiation so I could meditate and overcome that karma. And here all these people keep coming to him and getting initiation freely and easily, and I'm not getting it. And again and again and again he had to do this, to roll a big cornerstone up that hill. Took all his strength, and to find at the end of building the building that wasn't where he was supposed to build it. At one point, Guru Marpa, when Milarepa said, but you did tell me to do it here. And Guru Marpa said, well, I must have been drunk. Which I thought is a classic. Finally, he was in such total despair that he just didn't feel that life was worth living. At the end of all of that, his guru gave him the initiation. But he said, your karma was such that you had to be thrown into despair 8 times before you would be even fit to receive initiation. And because of your determination and devotion and willpower, you have been able to work it through in this lifetime. Most people would have taken many lives of despair and hopelessness and so on before they worked it out. And so it often seems you go through bad periods, you go through times of trying and thinking you've understood, and then you fall into it again and again and again, and it looks hopeless. But as long as the effort is right, and as long as you keep trying, you will find that suddenly that breakthrough comes. And that's not for you to say. You never know, as I said, how much of the nail is left in the board. All you do know for sure is that if you keep tugging away, even a deep karma can be overcome finally. Just be joyful that you're on the right path, and this is the lifetime to get rid of those things. These are things we've all got, in one way or another, things that we've got to struggle with. Everyone's lesson is different. Everyone's test is different. And what we should do is not feel sad that we have the test, but grateful and joyous that we have the opportunity to pass that test. Because most people are sunk in delusion. Master said another interesting thing. He said, as long as you make the effort, God will never let you down. If you give up, then you're lost, at least for this incarnation. But if you keep on trying, even at the moment of death, it may be something so deep-seated that you can't overcome it all your lifetime. And yet, if you just resolutely keep trying, even at the moment of death, many times, such things have been taken away forever. This is a very important point to remember, that the soul, being ever free, cannot be forever subject to any delusion. It cannot be. The important thing is that you keep trying. And if you do keep trying, there is no cause for discouragement. There is the temptation to be discouraged, But there is no good cause for discouragement. We just have to turn that negative emotion of discouragement, which in itself is a temptation and a delusion, we have to turn that temptation to be discouraged into a resolute effort to try again and keep trying. And as many times, remember this very, very important point, that when you break a bone and it heals, the point where it heals is stronger than the rest of the bone. And so when you have a fault and you work on it and work on it and work on it, and if it takes a whole lifetime or lifetimes, when you finally overcome it, that is your shining virtue. This is very important to remember. So, again, the energy that we direct, it has to be directed toward God. He's the only one who can take us out of it. And remember, He doesn't mind your faults. He knows that you've got faults. He knows we've all got faults. The only thing He minds is that we love Him enough. However many faults we have, if we keep trying, He will be more pleased with us for having faults and trying than for having no faults and not trying. He is more pleased with the sinner who loves Him than with the virtuous man who's indifferent to Him or whose devotion is lukewarm. Because the sinner who loves, the sinner who struggles and tries, is the one who is putting out that kind of energy that can free him. In fact, I remember, sort of comical sidelight, a friend of mine, a woman, told me that when she was a girl, she was Catholic and went to confession every week because it was what the schoolgirls had to do. And so she would deliberately do something wrong so she'd have something to confess. Well, we could turn that in a positive way for ourselves and be grateful that we've got something obvious to work on, because that gives us an incentive to work hard. Where those people who don't have obvious things to work on sometimes take it too easily. They don't have strong passions, strong emotions, big faults, and so they're sort of lukewarm, and they tend to sort of drift along. I remember this one woman at Mount Washington telling me that she meditated less after coming to Mount Washington because she felt sort of carried along by the peace there. And it was in a way good for her to have been away, because that was where she felt the need and the incentive to try more. I don't say that it was really good, because things were being developed in her through the sheer influence of being there that were good for her. But anyway, to bring it down to this really very important point, don't be too sorry for your mistakes. Don't be too sorry for your faults. In a way, you have cause to be grateful for them, because they may well be, if you're a sincere devotee, they may well be the incentive you need to grow. That doesn't mean be smug in them. But if it's a big fault, just say, thank God, I've got something big to work on, and that makes me want to try all the harder. And that way you'll be able to convert what is a negative emotion, sorrow, frustration, disappointment, despair, all these negative feelings, convert them into a positive one of, I'll just keep trying. Many times the person with the least talent comes out on top because he tries the hardest. So, yes, it's discouraging. Of course it's discouraging when we fail. The important thing is, again, to turn that negative emotion, offer that negative thing to God. You can even do it this way. We say God is the doer. Then we can say, all right, God, it was you who failed. You did it through me. Master said God likes that. To make him the doer of everything means not to just say, oh, you mean it was good enough to say God was the doer? Oh, okay. No, everything that you did, God is the doer. And if you really muff it, God is the doer. You'll find that if you can keep that thought strongly in your mind, there's a lot of freedom with it. It's a thought to be entertained seriously. So, these are ways.